This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? It's not fair. Throw it away. All right? All right!
They're coming! The rats are coming! Thousands of them!
Tell me about Disneyland.
They got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord! It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Hey, wait! There's something weird here.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family. This is a special edition of the Really Awful Movies podcast, episode 96. We're joined by Scott Drebbit, who's a columnist at Daily Dead, where he's got a great column called Drive-In Dust-Offs. And we're talking killer monkey movies. We're going to be discussing Monkey Shines, An Experiment in Fear, and Chacma.
I'm really excited about these two very divergent movies. We got New World versus Old World Monkeys. We've got one with a complete absence of plot, and the other one with way too much plot.
And speaking of monkeys, I mean, we got Scott back on the line.
Yeah.
And
that's okay. All right, I'll take it.
Scott, of course, is one of our absolute favorite guests for the podcast. This is his third go-round. I can't believe he's coming back for a third helping. I thought the first and second would have turned you off completely.
I need to get a phone blocker, I'm telling you.
We just keep on harassing you. But, no, we love talking to Scott, and we're really excited to talk about two films that at least one of them made a monkey out of me.
This is true.
Well, the first one, of course, is George A. Romero's, I don't want to say classic, because I don't know if it really is, but Monkey Shines.
Monkey Shines. Okay. If I may start.
You may start.
First, I'd like to directly address Mr. Romero. I'm a huge, huge fan. Having said that, George, and I love you. George, I love you if you're listening, and I know you are. But this is not your greatest movie. As much as I tolerate it and enjoy it on some kind of perverse level, I think, as Chris was saying, there's a little bit of an overabundance of plot. I think the last time I counted, there's at least four subplots too many.
Mm-hmm.
At least. And you have Tom Savini doing special effects, which...
which were indistinguishable. I couldn't see any of his work.
I think he sat around and smoked cigars on the set.
Yeah.
And just told people stories about making Dawn of the Dead.
You got it.
There's really no special effects going on.
Unless you count that really fake-looking monkey that was in the character's teeth near the end when he's kicking him to and fro, if Savini fabricated that puppet, that was maybe some of Savini's worst work I've ever seen.
Well, you know, it kind of reminds me. I don't know if you ever watch if you guys have seen Triumph the Insult Comic Dog, but the extended arm that he uses to pass people the microphone, etc. It's kind of, sort of, maybe about that level. I don't think monkey work is Savini's strong suit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they probably should have gotten Rick Baker, I think, if they wanted, you know, for monkey work.
if I'm starting off in a nutshell, George, like I said, I love you. Not your finest effort. And I think it's also, it's because it's right in that horrible, horrible sweet spot of late 80s, mid-90s video wasteland where just about every single movie was so bland and so point and shoot, no style. But I think it's that whole malaise of that wasteland of the late 80s, mid-90s that unfortunately he couldn't get himself out of.
Mm-hmm. Now, to be fair, I mean, this was Romero's first studio-backed film. Every film he made prior to this one was an independent production. And this was his first film with studio dollars. It was Orion who released this one. And they did tinker with it quite a bit, which led Romero to forego any other studio films until he made The Dark Half, I believe, in the early part of the 90s.
Yeah, which ended up getting shelved for a couple of years because Orion went under, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. The Dark Half is not a fun exemplar of Romero's work either, so...
No, but much, I thought it was much better just because I think the source material was much stronger. I mean, Romero himself wrote Monkey Shines based on the book, I think, by Michael Stewart. Mm-hmm. I haven't read the book. But, oh my God, it's, you know, it's about a half an hour too long.
Oh, yeah.
And, as we said, there's like, he's juggling like four subplots that almost none of them need to be there, other than as, you know, as a food fodder for Ella, our little cappuccino monkey.
I got to say, I was rather taken aback by the preponderance of male buttock nudity at the beginning. It was almost like the Terminator. You have this muscled, chiseled guy doing these ridiculous calisthenics.
Actually, it's funny you said that because my notes here are opens with a very impressive shot of nude male athleticism.
And it's like, okay, we know, we get it. He's going to become a quadriplegic. Like, we don't need to see him, you know, like bench press 700 pounds or do all these other fantastic athletic feats. But my God.
Yeah, it is a touch of porno aerobics going on at the start there. I mean, we only get 1 second of Janine Turner's ass.
A little side.
And then we get a 1 minute credit scroll of Jason Beige's ass.
Mm-hmm.
Before he picks up the bricks and hits the road for his morning jog.
Now, I want to comment on two things you just said. First of all, yes, we only got about a millisecond of Janine Turner's butt and a bit of side boob. Thankfully, I can compensate because as a youngster, I had Janine Turner's issue of Playboy, where she posed for the magazine. So that was one of my favorites.
She was in Playboy?
She was in Playboy. I'm 95% sure. Unless I'm getting confused with Sherilyn Fenn. I know Sherilyn Fenn was in Playboy. You know, they're both sort of...
I'm 95% excited that Janine Turner was in Playboy.
I mean, they're both sort of early 90s television entrepreneurs, right? Shirley Fenn on... Sherilyn Fenn on Twin Peaks and Janine Turner on Northern Exposure.
Speaking of exposure, yeah.
But, yeah, we could have definitely used a bit more Janine Turner nudity. The other thing that you mentioned was the lack of style. You know, in this film. And, yeah, I mean, it was pretty much static camera work. I mean, there was nothing that, you know, this is the work of a true horror auteur. Although I will say that the one scene that I thought was impressive was when Alan, our lead character, gets hit by the car, and there's a very impressively shot, yet ridiculously looking double Lutz in the air.
That was like some warped participation ad from the 80s, which any Canadian listener will remember participation, but my God, that is so ridiculous with the bricks flying up in the air and him pirouetting as he gets hit by the vehicle. Oh my God, there's part of me that absolutely loves this movie because he really is trying to make a first-rate suspense thriller, and there's little scenes that work, I think, and it's just, and I don't mind ridiculous. I'm the first guy to line up for ridiculous, mm-hmm. But my God, it's just so. If he trimmed it down by even 20 minutes and made it more of a, and his last name is Man, so I liked what you did there. Man versus Monkey, if it was more of a direct a meeting of the minds, so to say, between Ella and Alan, I think it would have ended up working a lot better.
Mm-hmm. Now, we got to talk about Ella, because Ella is actually played by Boo, who happens to be a male. But what a performance. If anybody came out of this one, like, deserving some sort of Academy Award nomination, I would have to say it would have been Boo. I mean, that's one damn expressive monkey.
Very impressive performance, to be totally honest. I mean, all the performances are good, but yeah, of course, you always look at and see how well the animals react that are trained to do this kind of thing, because your mind does tend to wander when he's having his 17th conversation with his mother about how he's
mother.
Whoever trained Ella or Boo in the performance of Ella, very, very good, very convincing. Like you said, very convincing performance by Boo. Very impressive.
Yeah. Oh, that scene where they were, where Alan and Ella were, I guess, you were dancing, so to speak, in his wheelchair. It was adorable. It was touching. It was incredible. I shed a tear.
Well, sure, tears are good. Tears, absolutely. it's the interaction between Alan and Ella, like you said, is very effective.
Mm-hmm.
The interactions between Alan and Jeffrey, his research scientist buddy, are very effective. I'll even allow the romantic angle, because it's necessary, between Alan and
Melanie,
mm-hmm. and the romantic triangle there. That's absolutely essential. Every other subplot has got to go. You have Janine Turner, the ex-girlfriend. How do you waste Stanley Tucci in a movie?
Yeah, and talk about
that?
Bad bedside manners. Like, as a doctor, he goes after the ex-girlfriend of a guy who's now a quadriplegic.
Still girlfriend, really. Yeah, but then, yeah. He's just macking
like, of all the women to go for in the world.
Yeah, he's macking on the girlfriend of the guy that's convalescing that you just performed, you know, supposed life-saving surgery on. Now, it's interesting because, yeah, for a minute or two, I was watching, because I've seen this movie, I saw it maybe about, I don't know, 8, 9 years ago, and I have wanted to see everything that Romero has done, and I just dismissed it as, yeah, this is lesser Romero, it's dull, there's not much going for it. I totally forgot that Stanley Tucci was in it, and
I'm sure as did he.
Quite true. So when I was rewatching it, and I saw that character, Dr. John Wiseman, and I was like, wait, is that Stanley Tucci? And I didn't quite go so far in my research to see like where this rests in his filmography. I know this movie was a film debut of Stephen Root, but who plays that's another subplot that went nowhere, you know, the nefarious dean is trying to steal Jeffrey's research.
There you go, right? You have Stanley Tucci, fantastic character actor. You have Stephen Root, one of my all-time favorite character actors, as Burbage,
mm-hmm.
Dean Burbage or Dr. Burbage, or whatever the hell he was. Yeah, that makes... You have a subplot for one of the side characters, you know, and then you have the nurse who's hired
mm-hmm.
to look after Marianne, who's a great actor. Christine Ford is a great actor.
Who also happens to be Romero's wife to this day.
Yes, and she's terrific in it, but she has no reason to be there other than to stop her parakeet from flying into Alan's mouth. Like, oh my god!
Yeah.
Why are you people here?
Mm.
I can't believe this is our second in a row podcast of a dive-bombing parakeet.
That's true.
Because we just covered Nightmare on Elm Street 2, and we're just... How many more killer green birds can we take?
Now, I gotta listen to that. I haven't listened to that podcast yet. But you guys better have been kind to Nightmare 2.
We were fairly fair. The reality is, we said, it's not a good Nightmare on Elm Street movie. But it's not a bad 80s slasher movie. That was our conclusion about Nightmare on Elm Street 2.
Okay. I think that it is not a... It doesn't follow the mythology of Nightmare on Elm Street, but I think it's very well directed. Mm-hmm. I think the story is a hot fucking mess, but I think it's very well acted, and if they do a textbook, and they definitely should, on homoeroticism,
oh, yeah.
Whether it's subliminal or not, in horror movies, this should be the largest section of said book.
No doubt about it. And
which one of us three has the body and which has the mind?
The brain.
Oh, the brain, yeah.
Oh, my God.
It just sort of reminds me of, like, you know, the Pet Shop Boys, you know, you got the looks, I got the brain, let's make lots of, let's kill lots of teenagers.
And I just absolutely adore that movie. That's the first Nightmare that I saw in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly think it's one of the better directed of the Nightmares. I know the story's a hot mess, I know it doesn't follow the mythology, but as far as the sequels go of Nightmare, because you don't touch the first, of course, but as far as the sequels go, for me, 3 is my fave. I know that's a go-to with a lot of people, but I always put 2 behind, and 2 is kind of the redheaded stepchild of the series, and I mean, it has Clue Gulager in it.
I know. But,
you know, I mean, my God, Kim Myers,
mm-hmm.
is that her name?
Kim Myers, the Meryl Streep doppelganger, yep.
My God, I had such a thing for her, more so than Mark Patton ever did, I have no doubt. Dee was just terrific. I know we're getting off track, but my God, I can rewatch Nightmare 2 more than any of the others except for 3.
Mm-hmm.
4 and 5 and 6 are like a really, liked them at the time, but I have a hard time revisiting them. They just reek too much of the era for me.
Mm-hmm.
But 2 I absolutely love, and I'll fight to the death for 2, man.
Objectively, it's a terrible Nightmare on Elm Street movie because for the reasons that you said. I mean, it does not follow the mythology that was set out in the first movie, the rules, etc. But there is something uniquely endearing about it, and say what you will about Mark Patton and, the ongoing controversy to this day about the homoerotic overtones and subtext, it really was text, and whether or not Scholder was complicit, and he claims he had no idea, which I think renders him completely naive. But
No, that's there's no way, and why be coy about it? There's no way he didn't know when he was filming that stuff, but this is a little kinky.
But it's entertaining, and I mean, as the first sort of male scream queen, Mark Patton acquits himself quite well.
He's fantastic. He's a really good. I mean, he was coming off of Broadway.
Mm-hmm. Come back to Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, I believe.
Yeah, Jimmy Dean. In Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean. Yeah, that's right. No, he's a terrific actor. As a matter of fact, that's one of the better casts. Again, shining a little light on it. That's one of the better casts of the entire series as far as acting ability goes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have Hope Lang and Clue as the parents, come on. Patton and Myers, Robert Russler, who's also another great actor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a terrific cast, and I think it's really stylishly shot and directed. I think Scholder made 3 great films, Alone in the Dark, mm-hmm. which is terrific.
The Hidden.
And this one and The Hidden.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. And as hot of a mess as it is, I think it's a spectacular hot mess that still holds up to a lot of replays.
I think it's one of those movies, too. I mean, it gets better the more you watch it. The first time you see it, especially if you've seen the first, you're just like, what the fuck is this? And then, you move on to the third, you're like, okay, yeah, this is where it's at. And then, such is the cult of Freddy that people just forgave. I mean, 4 or 5. I mean, it was just getting nutty. He was no longer, he was the Henry Youngman of horror. But
yeah.
But it's a clear cut case of diminishing returns. Now, a New Nightmare, it had its merits. But when you go back and revisit Nightmare 2, and you forget about all the homoerotic overtones and so on, the fact that it does just flagrantly breaks all the rules, and just watching its own merit, it's not a bad movie. And that's, I think, what we learned from revisiting Nightmare 2 after so many years.
Well, absolutely, and it's part of the criteria for really going back and watching. You know, we collect these movies because we love to go back and watch them. And here's an example with Monkey Shines.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't seen it. I haven't seen Monkey Signs. That was a comedy starring the chimp from the MVP movies. No. I liked Monkey Shines when it came out on video back in 89. I want to say the movie was out in 88, so probably 89. Watched it on videotape and liked it fine enough, but completely forgot about it after it was done. And I hadn't watched it again until it was chosen for this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and watched it, and I had exactly the same feelings as I did when I watched it the first time, which was, it's okay, it's perfectly serviceable, and I forgot it again right after I had watched it, and that was last week, and I had to watch it again this morning to remember what happened in this thing.
Oh my lord, we made you watch Monkey Shines.
You made me watch this thing two more times for this podcast.
I apologize, Scott. I really do.
And it's strange because it does come alive at times, like when the monkey's wielding the straight razor. And one of my favorite lines, I think this is just fantastic, when, who was it, Dr. Jeffrey, is the Pankow character. He catches the lecherous Dr. Wiseman with the girlfriend of Alan, and he calls her a clinical cunt. And I was like, oh, it reminded me of, like, Susie Essman and Curb Your Enthusiasm. You car wash cunt. I was like, oh, my God. Where did this come from?
It's a movie of moments that doesn't hang together because there's just too much going on. And there's a great story here, I think, but so much is left unexplained or laid by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
Again, because, as we said, there's like four or five, there's four subplots for sure that don't need to be there other than they are fodder for Ella. They're kills, and whether that was mandated by the studio or whether it's in the book, I don't know. You know, it certainly feels like a movie that was made from a book because he decided, instead of streamlining it, to put every subplot that was probably in the book there, I'm assuming. I haven't read the book.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised. I mean, with your crap research, watching the film twice, you didn't also read the book. You know?
I could write the book after seeing this thing a couple times in 2 weeks. But yeah, no, like you're saying, there are certain little moments in it. The face-off moments between Alan and Ella are really good.
Mm-hmm.
The last half hour is pretty solid, but the hour and a half to get there is very slim pickings. Having said that, you know, the performances are really good. My VIP, personally, is if you pronounce his name Beige, Jason, is it Beige or Beige or Beige?
What? It's one of those weird, you know, consonant combinations that you don't see too often. You know, it's sort of, I really don't know. I believe it's Beige, but it could very easily be Beggy or...
You know, I'm
just going to call him Beige.
Call him Beige. Yeah. Beige. Or just call him Jason.
Am I wrong, but was he sort of channeling Marlon Brando at times?
Listen, he can't move his arms, he can't move his legs, so he has to express himself by pulling his eyes very tightly together every time he's angry. Which is a lot in this movie because he has some anger management issues.
Indeed, yep.
This is our house. You have been hired to perform certain functions in it. And when you don't perform those functions, we get pissed off.
And just who is this we you're talking about?
Me and Ella.
That's what I thought you meant. It's unnatural, you and that monkey. She is just a dirty, filthy, sneaky little
beast. You don't like the way this place looks? Well, she's the one that leaves it such a mess.
Marianne, come back here.
You know, I've seen him in other movies, and he is a good actor. It's a choice that he made in this movie to express himself that way, and it's hilarious, and I love it. But he is a good actor, and I'm not here, and I'm going to call him Beige because I think we should call them by their last names because this is very academic.
Exactly. That's what I tell my students all the time.
And we're professionals, damn it, and we're going to call him Beige.
Okay.
And I'm going to just say Beige.
Consistency
over.
Is key. We'll call him Beige.
Beige is fine. Beige is fine. My actual favorite performance is Pankow as Jeff.
Yep.
I really, really, really like him here. And I love him also in To Live and Die in L.A., and which is surprising because I absolutely can't stand him on Mad
About You.
Yeah.
Yep.
You guys both watch that show then. I've never watched that show. So.
Seinfeld light. Yeah, it's pretty bad.
It was Seinfeld light, but it was back in the day where your channels were limited and it was on, and it wasn't... I liked Paul Reiser, didn't like Helen Hunt, but I couldn't stand his character on the show. He was Paul Reiser's cousin, and I couldn't stand him on that show. And every time I see him away from that show, like as William Peterson's partner in To Live and Die in L.A., and here, he's a terrific actor. I thought I was more interested in what was going on with him and his character's point of view than I was what was going on with Beige.
Mm.
But my God, the nurse got to go. Mm-hmm. The like I said, the 17 moments between him and his mother where, you know, she's overbearing and all that. That's
mother, can you hear me? Can you hear me? Mother, mother, mother. I'm thinking, in my mind, I'm thinking Yentl, you know, like, Papa, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, it's like we said, if you took everything that was good away from this movie and made like a tight hour and a half movie, it would be a really solid late 80s thriller, I think.
Yep. I don't know much about helper monkeys or people who need, you know, assistance with their day-to-day activities, but I don't know if I would conscript a monkey that's straight out of a research laboratory for that task.
No, he seems to accept it, wholeheartedly, but I think, you know, that's because, Pankow's his best friend, so he goes along with it.
Yep.
Having said that, I mean, what are the odds that monkey, if you piss him off, is going to grab a handful of his own shit and shove it down your throat? As a paraplegic, what are you going to do?
And, you know, I will say, I mean, another credit to this movie, Beige and Pankow, they do have good chemistry together. I mean, I did buy them as best friends, and I did buy, you know, the concern that Jeffrey had for his friend Alan. That was somewhat touching and believable.
Absolutely. Like I said, there's only four people who should be in this movie. The rest should have 2 minutes of screen time tops, and that's Melanie, Alan, Jeffrey, and Ella. It's the only four that count in the movie, and if it was just those four, and everyone else got maybe a minute that you spent on Mom Comes By to Visit, here's your nurse, you know, we leave, and then you don't even need the nurse to be there other than comes in, changes them, and then she gets killed by Ella, and that's all I want to know about the nurse. I don't give a shit that her parakeet's name is Bogey, or she's jealous that Ella's there and it's taking away her job and she's going to be on unemployment. I don't know.
I did enjoy the part when Alan calls her Nurse Ratchet. I got a little chuckle out of that, but...
Without these fringe characters, you would not have had the mother-son bathing, trussed-up bathing scene.
Oh. I don't care if I was a quadriplegic.
I know. Have you ever seen the movie The Baby?
Now that's an entertaining movie.
Yes.
That is a much more entertaining movie than than Monkey Shines. So that was a different... That's the early 70s when everything and anything got put on the screen if it had a chance to make money. They didn't give a shit. My wife who works for... My wife actually works for social services, and I couldn't imagine her ever being put in a situation like this. It's kind of a unique one where you have a grown man who's being raised as a baby. I don't think social services alone would cover the shit storm that this would cause. I think you might want to get the authorities of a higher nature involved in a family that's keeping their grown-ass son dressed and clothed and fed as a baby.
Yes, that's indeed. Yeah, that, I mean, that's that movie, The Baby, is one for the ages. If somebody wants to see something that's just going to make them go, what the fuck is this? The Baby.
It's a great what the fuck. It's an all-time what the fuck movie, and I think it's got to be, folks, it's streaming out there somewhere. Go do yourself a favor, and Ted, I think Ted Post directed it, and go check out Monkey Shines if you want. Hey, I've seen it twice in 24, or like in 48 hours. But take my word for it. Go watch The Baby instead.
Well, yeah, I was thinking, I mean, as we were talking about Monkey Shines, and, you know, we're mentioning all these subplots that went nowhere, and I'm thinking, hey, you know what, maybe 2 hours wasn't enough. Maybe we needed like a 3-hour director's cut in order to tie everything together.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine? There's probably a half an hour more of him chastising his mother for... You know, and then we probably got a whole subplot with Janine Turner and Stanley Tucci at the vacation in Rome or something.
Yeah.
I can just imagine the delights that would await us in a 3 hours director's cut of this.
George, if you're listening, you got that footage on the cutting room floor? Maybe Shout Factory or somebody might, maybe that's something.
George, we love you.
We do love you.
From the bottom of our hearts, we absolutely adore you. And we don't blame you for Monkey Shines, George. Mm-hmm. I'm going to blame, you know what, I'm going to blame Beige, George, because, just because I can't blame you for anything, but this is not your best movie, and no. You would probably say so yourself.
So instead of blaming on the boogie, you're going to blame it on Beige.
There you go, blame it on the Beige. That's that great Milli Vanilli classic.
If you gotta blame it on something, right? Blame it on the Beige.
You gotta blame it on something. Might as well blame it on the Beige.
So any final thoughts on Monkey Shines then?
You know what? I'd have to watch it for a third time in the past week to really summarize how I feel about it, but I'm not going to do that.
Right.
But so if I'd have to say, you know what, if you're a George Romero completist, and if you are, and you should be.
Exactly.
You need to check out everything that he's seen, because every movie that he's made, even if they're not entirely successful, have successful moments and are interesting to let you know where he is at that point in his career. There's always something interesting going on in the Romero films, so for those who haven't seen it, don't be discouraged and watch it anyway. Mm-hmm. It's worth it to see it once, to see the movie that it could have been. So it's not completely without merit, but for anyone who hasn't seen it, see it once, forget about it like I did, and then
see it again. Yeah, it makes you wonder why they even bothered with this telepathic connection, because they have all this backstory of this monkey in the lab. It could have just gone apeshit and just attacked everyone, and then they could have just cut 40 minutes out of this thing, and that would have been just perfectly fine.
That sort of
fine.
Happened to the next movie we were going to talk about. But,
the telekinetic angle, I mean, that's obviously the big sell of the movie,
it's so tepid.
I can't shine anymore. I can't shine anymore, mother!
Well, you know, I mean, look, the horror auteurs that we all love and adore, and I'm talking about, of course, Romero and Craven and Carpenter and Cronenberg, not one of them has batted 1,000. Not one of them.
No.
They all have their misfires, and yet those misfires, I would argue, are just as integral to appreciating their work as their triumphs. You know, you sort of have to see, as you said before, like, where were they at this point in their career to appreciate
they're masterpieces.
Well, my God, I mean, you have to watch Ghosts of Mars to say, wow, Assault on Precinct was a really fucking good movie.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have to watch Vampires to say, The Fog is fantastic.
You got it, yep.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, exactly, same as you have to say, well, Cronenberg, you know, anything after...
Eastern Promises.
Well, History of Violence.
He kind of, he drifted away from horror, mm-hmm. So...
Yeah.
But yeah, like you're saying, you have to, and it's always interesting if you study these things to watch their less successful features, mm-hmm. because like you said, it really does make you appreciate how much greater their great works are.
And you know, just to go on it, well, I mean, it's related, but it is a tangent, and to talk about one of your favorites, Don Coscarelli, I personally despised John Dies at the End. Did you see that?
Really?
I did.
Oh, yeah. No, I own John Dies at the End. Mm-hmm. I've only watched it once, but why despise?
Because I read the book, and I adored the book, and there's so much... And when I heard that Don Coscarelli was doing an adaptation of John Dies at the End, and Paul Giamatti was going to be in it, and I was like, oh, man, this is going to be incredible. And it's just... There's so much in the book that's not in the movie. It lacks the spirit of the book. I found it to be... the casting was wrong. It was wrong, 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 wrong. Now, having said that, maybe if I hadn't read the book, I would have liked it that much better.
Okay, yeah, see, I have the book, but I haven't read the book. And I bought the movie, and I've watched the movie once, and I like the movie. But now, is it one of those unfilmable... books, much like when Cronenberg did Naked Lunch.
Mm-hmm.
The Naked Lunch movie is almost has, you know, nothing to do with the book, but is an interesting movie in its own right.
Mm-hmm.
So is it a case of, is it an unfilmable book?
I would say so. Yeah, I think that I think maybe trying to adapt John Dies at the End into an hour and a half film was just biting off way more than you can chew. And Don Coscarelli was game, he gave it his all, but it just, at the end of it all, it disappointed me, so...
Well, at least we don't need a spoiler alert, right? John dies at the end, or...?
He doesn't die at the end.
Oh, well, there you go. In fact, spoiler alert!
There's another book afterwards, which I highly recommend. It's a sequel called This Book is Full of Spiders. The sequel to John Dies at the End. And they're both...
And I have that book, too, and I haven't read that yet, but I've heard great things about the books, and I look forward to reading them someday. But yeah, no, he actually doesn't die at the end.
No,
of John Dies.
Not at all. Perhaps it's the most misleading title since...
Naked Lunch.
Naked Lunch, there you go, yeah. That, but it's the most misleading title since Naked Lunch, where there was no eating of lunch, nor nudity.
Come in full circle.
Naked Lunch is neither naked, or is it a meal.
There you go,
exactly.
Yeah.
And speaking of something that is kind of low on nutrients... Shakma.
Yeah, so this is the second in our monkey double feature.
Oh my lord.
That was a lovely segue.
I gotta say, I had to laugh. On YouTube, there was a commenter, and the first comment there said, you know what this movie needs more of? Walking around empty hallways. And I thought, it's just, how much wandering around in a movie can there be? My god.
Now, you know what? When we cemented that these were the two movies that we were going to talk about, and so then I was, like I said, I had actually seen Shakma about sometime last year, because it's on Shudder,
mm-hmm.
and if I may quickly, because I want a free subscription, everybody rent Shudder.
Mm-hmm.
They are the boutique of leathers of horror streaming. I don't even know what that means, but I'm going with it. It's a terrific service, and Shudder,
mm-hmm.
Please give me a free subscription, because I'm on there all the time, and I always leave pithy comments about the movies I watch. Okay, so, I watched Shakma last year, and it was the first time I'd seen it. It was one of those that had slipped by me at the video store all those many years ago, because I thought it had a really shitty cover, to be honest. And didn't seem that interesting to me. And it had Christopher Atkins, which surprisingly held no appeal for me whatsoever.
Really? So, I mean, the Blue Lagoon, One Night in Heaven, these are not movies that are on your shelf?
seen The Blue Lagoon. I've seen One Night in Heaven. Neither of these would be my 100 greatest movies of the 80s.
Yeah, please.
What surprised me is that I actually really enjoyed Shockwave.
Amazing.
And I did, because it does everything. It streamlines everything that Monkey Shines doesn't.
Ah, okay.
It has the simplest of premises. It's a monkey. It's sorry about it. Is it the baboon? Right.
It's a baboon. Yeah.
It's a baboon chasing around a bunch of people in an abandoned building for the weekend, and it's incredibly violent and brutal and nihilistic, and it's like they took out all the shitty extraneous stuff from Monkey Shine, and this is kind of the movie that you would be left with. Now, is it as artfully made as Romero's? No. Is it as well acted or developed as George's? No, it's not. But you throw the damn thing on, you can take a piss, you can take a salad, you can come back, and you're guaranteed to see, like you mentioned, A, someone walking down a hallway trying to open the door. You see those red ass cheeks slamming into the door. It's not a good movie, but it has this kind of manic energy to it that really kind of took me back. It wasn't what I was expecting. So, since we're talking about the two, and if I'm comparing the two, if I have to go back, revisit one of these movies again, I'm leaning to the right, and I'm going to take Shockma. Over.
Over. There you go. The next thing I was going to say to you was going to be punctuated with over. I've never heard the word over uttered more in a movie in my entire life. Into gigantic walkie-talkies with the most comically elongated antennas I've ever seen.
And yeah, we just got to say, for people who haven't had the pleasure of seeing this, the entire plot can be summarized on a business card. Basically, a bunch of medical students are playing a role-playing game, and a baboon gets loose and starts killing them. Now, that's essentially it, and I was wondering, what kind of medical students have all this free time to spend their Friday nights doing this, of all things, and why is the dean involved?
Well, he's the game master. Yeah, remember, that's Roddy McDowall as the game, not the game master, okay? Although it's at certain times, because Roddy McDowall is an openly gay actor, and he was referred to over and over again as the game master, and at just certain times you hear the game master, you know?
Okay, so the dean
was Roddy McDowall gay? Are you guys serious?
Him and Liberace. I mean, there was a question, but I know.
No, when deans of medical schools are not out there securing grants or funding, they spend their Friday evenings involved in role playing. Yeah, and they look like Bill Nye, the science guy.
You also forgot to mention, though, in your description of the movie that fits on the business card, which is absolutely correct, that these are, let's forget, they're playing a live-action role-playing game, which that's kind of in vogue before, they were ahead of the curve, because that's huge now, but it was something new for them. This was the first time they were playing a live. But let's keep in mind that these are the best-looking medical students, not the geeks and the freaks. These are the good-looking medical students that are playing the live-action role-playing game. There's no way in hell that these people would be staying home on a Friday night with their walkie-talkies playing a role-playing game and not out getting laid in a club.
And they're rich, too. They laid down a $500 wager.
No, five C-notes. You gotta get it,
girl. Yeah,
sorry, not using the terminology. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what they refer to it, so let's put down a C-note.
Just like university students are wont to do.
Yeah, indeed.
But, you know, so the movie gets plus 10 points for having Roddy McDowall in it, because it makes any movie more eminently watchable with his sing-song, sighing, talking the way he speaks, and it's just, everything sounds so sad and forlorn. whenever he speaks.
Poor
and
Ronnie.
I love him, and yeah. I think his name in this is it
Sorensen?
Is it Pepperpot or
Sven Sorensen or something? I don't know.
Yeah, Dean Sorensen.
Sorensen.
Yeah,
that's right. So I'm going to call him
Pepperpot. Consistency is key, so from now on we'll call him Pepperpot from here on in.
Well, if you're despondently sighing into a walkie-talkie, that's not the most, you know, it was a pretty thankless role.
Over.
Over.
You know, can I get room?
Breaker, breaker.
13 open, over. 13 over.
Yeah, no, poor Roddy. I mean, you're right with that sort of, like, that sad six. Because whenever I see Roddy, all I can think about is Class of 1984. You know?
When he has his meltdown.
Yeah.
They killed the rabbit.
Yep.
He's great. You know, all kidding aside, he's a very unique, but he definitely comes from the old school. He's a movie star. You know, he's not a character actor that gets lost in his role. If you want Roddy McDowall, you're getting fucking Roddy McDowall.
Mm-hmm.
You're not getting a character. You're getting Roddy McDowall plays Professor Pepperpot.
Now, Scott, I have a question about the finer points of this role-playing game.
Well, let's just say, you're right, they were ahead of the curve before you talk about the finer points. So, what do they call it? LARPers? Is that what they would be now?
Is that cosplay, whatever, yeah.
Is that terminology? Yeah. Live-action role-players?
Yeah, live-action, yeah, they're called LARPers.
Yeah, okay.
As someone who played Dungeons & Dragons once, painfully, with a group of 12-year-olds one night, yes, I am definitely an expert on live action or non-live action role playing.
Now apparently only two of them dressed up. One of them was dressed like Desdemona from Othello, like by way of a flamenco restaurant, and the other one was just wearing a mask, and no one else even bothered.
Well, no, because one is the nemesis,
right?
Bad guy that they can't run into, and the other one is
the princess.
Was played by Airi Myers, mm-hmm. the lovely, lovely Airi Myers, that gave me kind of certain feelings until I went back and scrolled, and she was 19 at the time that she made the movie.
Thank God for that, yeah.
Thank God for that, because I was having some conflicted feelings about her, and then I realized she was pretty much, I think she was the same age, same age as me.
Mm.
So, go figure. But she used to be on Kate and Ally, and speaking of god-awful sitcoms, she was on Kate and Ally, which was one of the, it's in that special ethereal zone. What am I, is that even English? Did I say English word? like a small wonder, and one of those where the vacuum of laughs just sucks out your eyeballs. It's one of those shows. But she was on that, and that's where, when I saw Shakira for the first time, the movie we're talking about, I'm like, oh, that's the Kate and Ally girl. And she's cute and lovely in this, and again, she really has not much to do with it, but I don't even know what am I talking about?
Well, if you had access to a completely abandoned university hospital, I would think maybe laser tag?
Laser tag would be awesome. Laser tag, and then just release Shockma.
The titular.
And then that would be awesome. But, you know, as you were saying, it's such a plotless movie. So thank God, though, that it actually does contain a lot of action. Otherwise, it would be, I'm going to try to use interminable. Hey, look at that. I got that word out. It would be more interminable than Monkey Shines. So it does move quickly, and like I said, when I watched it last year, I thought it was going to be a real hot mess, but I actually found myself enjoying it. It has this weird kind of kinetic energy to it and nastiness that I wasn't expecting from like a late 80s kind of direct-to-video movies, especially something starring Christopher Atkinson, and God bless him, you know, he really goes for, he has this turning point in the movie where his brain kind of snaps, and then it becomes, again, to correlate with Monkey Shines, it becomes the man against nature moment, mm-hmm. where he has the chance to phone the police, that he has them on the phone, and he says, no, fuck that. This bitch has killed my girlfriend. Spoiler alert.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking it out. I'm taking Shockma downtown.
Now you made a personal Shockma.
Exactly. It's like that. It's like Lorraine Gary and Brucey's mother in Jaws the Revenge.
Mm-hmm.
It's personal. And he straps up and he's got this, you know, semi-wild look in his eyes. And I thought, you go, Chris. You act the shit out of this material. Awesome. He goes for it.
Yep. I was going to say, if it wasn't for movies like this one and Monkey Shines, I mean, hey, would we have that wonderful Liam Neeson, Star of the Grey, you know? The wonderful man versus nature flick. I mean, these were the progenitors.
They were they absolutely were. And is Christopher Atkins as good of an actor as Liam Neeson? Maybe. I don't know.
We can't get in his mind for that now.
You know, the dust settles 30, 40 years from now when we look back and at Atkins' oeuvre, and say, hey, this kid, you know, he brought the goods. Maybe not. It's not for me to say. It's not up to me.
Mm-hmm.
Only the gods of cinema will judge one day. But having said that, I can't say I'm a Christopher Atkins completist.
Nor can he.
If I had to go back and someone said, if you have to pick one Christopher Atkins movie, this is the one I'm going for.
And, you know, speaking of the cast, and I mean, earlier we were talking about Nightmare on Elm Street, we would be remiss if we didn't bring up the fact that we have Amanda Weiss in this one. Tina, in the original Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yes, absolutely. And she's as lovely as she ever was in this, and she's perfectly fine as Tracy, I believe, is her character's name. I actually saw her, she was at the Calgary Horror Con last summer with Heather Langenkamp. They were both there. And I never spoke to either of them, but I saw them up close, and they both still were as lovely as ever, as was the lovely Dee Wallace, who looks amazing.
Hmm.
And Tom Atkins was there, but I ended up speaking with Barbara Crampton, who was also lovely. And I have no idea where that is going other than Amanda Wise is lovely, and a good actress, too, and she's good in it.
Yeah,
she always is.
Let's make a segue to what you said earlier about Funny Feelings and Barbara Crampton and some of her early movies.
Her body of work, yeah.
Certainly gave us some funny feelings, but she is a lovely woman and a great actress.
She is a lovely woman and she's a great actress, and when I met her in person, of course, I brought my slip cover for From Beyond, and I had her sign it, and we talked for a little bit, and I just blathered on and on. I had my daughter with me as I'm standing there blathering about Barbara Crampton and about how great an actress I thought she was, and I blathered and blathered and blathered, and she talked with my daughter for a bit, which was nice because it took the pressure off me from looking more like an idiot, and then we left, and I left a happy boy. But yes, she's a lovely actress, and she's not in Shockma.
No. So, yeah, I think we've had our fill of monkey talk, or monkey business, so to speak, and since we've got you on the line, and I mean, obviously, you're a horror expert, as we, you know, we value your opinions, and you brought up Heather Langenkamp, and, you know, Heather Langenkamp is sort of in a bit of a controversy nowadays in the world of horror, because she's appearing in this new Hellraiser film, which is...
Yes.
Everyone's going ape shit over, you know, speaking of apes and throwing shit and whatnot, yeah. What do you think about that? What are your thoughts on, you know, yet again going for yet another Hellraiser sequel? No Barker, no Bradley. I don't know.
Personally, myself, I think I tuned out of the Hellraiser series probably after. I did see a couple of the direct to video ones, a couple of the first ones, one where Ashton Lawrence came back, and I think one that Stephen Dorff was in, does that sound right?
Yep.
Or Craig Sheffer. Was it Craig Sheffer or Stephen Dorff?
You know what, they're interchangeable, it doesn't really matter.
Stephen Dorff is a marker of quality.
Yeah.
They are, aren't they? and that's when they started doing the, where where they were just, where Dimension was just taking scripts and they were just kind of pigeonholing Pinhead in and calling them Hellraiser movies. So, you know, right from the time, and probably even before Bloodline, because that was the one where Kevin Yeager directed but took his name off because Dimension just cut the shit out of it. They wrested control from the series, from any kind of vision from the series, years and years ago. So rightly so, everyone was very excited when at one point there was the possibility of Barker being involved, and of course everyone assumed Doug Bradley. If Barker was involved, you would have Bradley involved, of course. And I don't know what happened there, but apparently Barker was out, and Bradley was out, and now you have Langenkamp in. That's one of those, I'll stand back from afar and see what reactions are to it and probably check it out at some point out of curiosity, but I'm certainly not holding out for any kind of goodness there. We could be surprised, who knows, but at this point in the game, unless someone's bringing a fresh vision to it, which I think it definitely needs, maybe it'll be around the same level as Revelations, which was, I did watch that one with the different actor as Pinhead, and that was a garbage fire if I've ever seen it.
Oh, without a doubt. I guess you would call me a mask. I mean, they're all on Netflix, every single one. So I basically subject myself to every single Hellraiser film. And if there's, you can't deny the incredibleness of the first movie. And the second one, the gore factor is off the charts. It's amazing. But I mean, if there is any sort of exemplar for Diminishing Returns when it comes to turning out sequel after sequel after sequel, it's got to be the Hellraiser series. And this really is just a gambit for Dimension to retain the rights to the character.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you see it again. You see it again and again in film, and it's. You see it in the superhero world, and you certainly see it in the horror world. And it's absolutely a way for them to retain the rights. And everyone was hoping for Barker's going to come back, because he just released the novel, the Scarlet Letters, which is supposed to be the pen. I haven't read it, but the penultimate Pinhead story. So you thought, okay, Barker's heading back to that world. Why has he not directed anything since Lord of Illusions? He was just getting, in my opinion, getting really good at directing.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess a bad taste in his mouth that he walked away from directing forever, which I just think is a horrible decision because I absolutely adore Lord of Illusions. And I thought he was just getting warmed up.
So that's going to bring me to my next question, Scott. In this community that we're a part of, this horror community, I mean, everybody... I won't even talk about... I mean, horror. Let's just talk about fandom in general. I mean, everybody is so... what's the word I'm thinking of? Now my English skills have deteriorated as well. Everyone is so...
Consumed?
Not consumed, but like when it comes to their favorites. I mean, they're just... I'm thinking about the whole Ghostbusters thing right now, with the remake and put the all-female Ghostbusters, and it's like, how dare you, it's untouchable, how dare you remake it, and how dare you cast an all-female cast, and this and that, and I'm just like...
Nothing's untouchable if it's well-made, and that trailer looked pretty bad.
Well, yeah, okay, but I'm going to wait and see. I mean, I think I see some potential in this one. And fandom in general is always a knee-jerk reaction, like, it's either going to be the greatest thing ever or the worst thing ever. People have their minds made up before the film... Even comes out, and
the new Paul Kersey is apparently Bruce Willis for the Death Wish reboot.
Oh yeah, Bruce Willis. Oh man, I have such a Bruce Willis malaise that I've had for probably the last 10 years or so. But you know what? Having said that, that does kind of fit the Charles Bronson. Hand me my check, and then I will say my fucking lines, and then I'm going home. So it does, in that sense, and I love Charles Bronson, which may have as much to do with the films themselves that he made and the whole, and he, you know, ended up his career with some great canon stuff there. You know, the Bruce Willis doing the Death Wish. Okay, and again, I try to take the let's wait and see, but like any fan of certain stuff, and Ghostbusters is a great example. Myself, because I like Paul Fake.
He had another name.
Yeah.
I actually think I actually like his films. I think he's a good director. I think he's a good writer. So, and I'm actually a fan of the women that are in the Ghostbusters. I liked the trailer. I wasn't overwhelmed by the trailer. I liked the trailer. Kate McKinnon is going to be an absolute star after this movie. Comes out, she pops off the screen. I don't know if it's her character or her herself, but she really stands out in the trailer, I thought. And I'm taking a real, I'm looking forward to it just because of the pedigree that's involved. The stigma, the whole Ghostbusters stigma. You know, I think it's great to be passionate about a franchise that you love. I know last year when it was announced that The Rock was going to be remaking or was thinking about remaking Big Trouble in Little China, my fucking head almost spun right off for a moment. And I caught myself and I went, you know, come on. It's not going to negate the Carpenter movie, just as the new Ghostbusters is not going to negate the original Ghostbusters. Go back and watch the original as many times as you want.
Indeed.
And don't go see the new one. But the vitriol and the hatred and the venom that's out there for this remake is like Frankenstein level torch-bearing levels. That is, it's kind of, it's weird and disproportionate and kind of, it throws me off, you know?
And I find it funny, too, because I recall when Ghostbusters 2 came out back in, I believe it was the summer of 89, and it didn't do very well. It didn't meet expectations at the box office. At the time, people did not like it. I liked it. But now, everybody retroactively was like, oh, yeah, no, Ghostbusters 1 and 2, I mean, they're incredible, and, you know, how dare you touch this series, and so on and so forth. But, you know, that was then. This is now. I mean, there won't be a Ghostbusters 3 with, you know, all the principals involved. Of course, Harold Ramis is no longer with us. Bill Murray would not sign off on any sort of sequel. But he did approve this one, and he's got a cameo in it. So, you know, like, let's just wait and see. And it could be a hot mess, but you know what? It may very well be a damn entertaining film.
It could be, it could not. But again, you know what, people? You can't criticize a movie that hasn't been made yet, or that's been made but hasn't come out.
Exactly.
The newest one down the pipeline, of course, just briefly, is the Batman versus Superman.
I was going to say, yeah, indeed.
And it's the exact same. It's the exact same thing as the Ghostbusters. People haven't seen it and are foaming at the mouth. And there's these, you know, the DC versus Marvel people. And there has been information leaked about the movie from insiders already, and it's getting decidedly mixed reviews, with certain people being spotlighted as very good. Ben Affleck, from what I hear, is very good as Batman. A Wonder Woman
steals the show, from what I hear.
Action,
yep,
is what I'm hearing, and is supposed to be very good. But it's an overstuffed movie, which usually happens. You know, can happen in a lot of superhero movies if it's not supposed to be an ensemble. You know, the Avengers works because it's supposed to be an ensemble and everyone gets more or less equal play. You know, that's different from a one person or two person superhero movie with this, but apparently it's an overstuffed movie. You know, but again, it hasn't come out. You haven't seen it and you're hearing someone's opinion. You know what? Chill the fuck out. Wait until the movie comes out. Go see it. And then give an opinion.
Sorry, Chris, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, it does have the second best Affleck in it.
No, come on. No.
Casey's a better actor.
Okay.
Come on.
But you could do way worse.
Right. No, I was gonna say. I mean, I personally am looking for. I'm a DC fanboy, and I'm looking forward to it. Not only am I a DC fanboy, I'm a Wonder Woman fanatic. So to finally see Wonder Woman on the big screen, I mean, this is the day I was waiting for. I can't wait to see it. My fear is that so many, and it's the same with the Ghostbusters, is that so many people have already made their minds up and that they're going to hate it, that like all the internet pundits, and you and I are basically, you know, we are, and Chris as well, we're internet pundits ourselves, have their reviews already written. You know, they're not going to go in with an open mind. They're not going to go in and say, well, let's just see if this is actually good or not. They're like, I hate it, I know I hate it, and nothing will sway me. And that's where I think fandom is today.
It is, and it's, and you know, and the internet is completely to blame for it. Back in, like, when we were kids, and Superman came out, you saw the preview, you said to your friends, we have to go see Superman, and they said, fuck yeah, we have to go see Superman, and then you went and saw Superman, and then you talked about the movie after it was over. Some liked it, some didn't, and that was it, other than you read an occasional review in, say, a Rolling Stone magazine or your local newspaper.
Yep.
Now it's right or wrong, I think it's great that everyone has an opinion on something, but everything on the internet is just, it's opinion, and it's opinion, you know, now we're reading about movies 2 years before they're coming out, and the old wheel starts turning already on it. Back in the day when I was reading, you know, Famous Monsters of Filmland, they would have an upcoming features on one of the pages, and it would just give the title. Or same with Starlog magazine.
I was going to say, yep. Starlog, yep.
A title of a movie that was, you know, probably being worked on. And you looked at the title, and then in your mind, you started formulating and wondering what this movie was going to be about. Now, it's every single detail as we go along there.
It's like the comic book guy from The Simpsons. It's like, I was on the internet within minutes registering my disgust.
Good one, man. That was a good imitation, I gotta say.
Yeah, Radioactive Man.
Yeah. God, I remember reading, I used to love Starlog, and I remember reading their feature on the upcoming Roger Corman adaptation of Fantastic Four, and man, did that whet my appetite for that movie. I was excited, you know? And we all know what happened to that one, right?
You know, and that's the thing, though. You should be excited to see a movie before it comes out. And I find myself more and more. I love reading people's opinions about stuff, but there comes a point where I find myself now putting on the brakes and saying, you know what? I don't want to hear any more about this movie. I specifically chose before I went and saw The Witch to not read anything about, not read a single review, nothing anywhere. And I went in as cold as I could be to The Witch. I mean, you know, my God, we write for horror websites, so there is some stuff I have to read about it. But others' opinions and early reviews, etc. And I went in cold. And first of all, I mean, the movie, I absolutely loved The Witch. Have you guys seen it yet?
I haven't, but, I mean, that is definitely an interesting exemplar of fandom today.
Yeah, no, I absolutely love The Witch, and but even more importantly, like I said, I tried to go in as cold as I could, and it completely made the experience that much greater for me, because I didn't know every little plot beat as it came, and I didn't know what, you know, Johnny Two-Thumb on this site thought about it, or, you know, Mary over here, what she thought about it, and the less opinions that I had about it going in, the fresher my take on it was, you know, was going to be, and did turn out being. And like I said, it went in pretty much cold, and it just made the experience that much better.
And, you know, it's funny that you brought up The Witch, because, I mean, it sort of brings our discussion back to horror, and, of course, fandom. And look at that movie, and look at how within 2 weeks, from the week before it opened, and then the week after, and how consensus is just changed on a dime. I mean, we went from, like, this is going to be one the greatest horror movie since The Exorcist to, like, fuck The Witch. You know what I mean? That was the internet consensus. It's insane. Like, it caused me whiplash. On one hand, it's like, this is going to be, this is it. Like, this is what horror fans have been waiting for. And then the next week, everyone's like, oh, The Witch is the worst movie ever. Worst movie ever. I mean, come on.
Yeah, as polarizing as The Babadook.
Well, that's another example. I mean, I love The Babadook, and, you know, again, it's either, like, you love The Babadook, or it's the worst movie ever. Like, why does everything have to be the worst movie ever? Why can't you just say, I didn't like it. It didn't meet my expectations. But you may like it.
Is it really the worst movie ever? At full people, have you ever seen Master of Disguise?
Exactly.
And shut up. But it's exactly what you're saying. But that's what I love about a movie like The Witch and The Babadook. It's a movie that, you know what? I don't want to talk about a movie that isn't, for me, a movie that is polarizing. That says something about the movie and that it gets a reaction from people. How many of the movies, the horror movies that we, you know, have to slog through, how many of them elicit, like, no reaction? Like, a large percentage.
Oh, yeah, like...
So when you have a movie that comes around that invites discussion and causes this kind of polarization, that's the mark of a movie that's going to be around for many, you know, for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And personally, myself, I think the people who hate the movie are the people who were going in with, they were riding the hype wave and they were expecting a certain type of movie, and those people, I think, are, you know, what I call the Rotten Tomato generation. My kids will ask me about a movie and they'll say, well, what did it get on, they'll want to go see a movie and they'll say, well, what did it get on Rotten Tomatoes? And I'll go, well, hold on, I can tell you the percentage, or I can tell you the 25 different reviews that I read about it, and give you a more, maybe slightly more nuanced perception of what it's about. Did you want to know what it's about? No, they just want to know what the percentage was. Was it, did it get, you know, above 60, or did it get like 30%? Well, if it's 30, I don't want to go see them. Mm-hmm. Well, hold on. The six people that gave it a good review are people that I actually trust, and I'm quite interested in seeing this one now. But it's the Rotten Tomatoes generation of, they go by the percentage. And so, you know, when it came to The Witch got a very high percentage, but I think that Rotten Tomato generation saw the good percentage, saw it was a movie, you know, it was a horror movie, and God bless them, they love horror movies, but, you know, you should go in with a little bit of knowledge about what kind of horror movie, you know, because we all have our preferences. Mm-hmm. Some of us like a slow burn, some of us like nonstop action, some of us like all of it, but there's the younger generation especially, you know, the slow burn just does not work for them. And so I think a lot of them went in with that. I went in on the, opening second weekend? It was up, opening weekend I went, Friday night, 7:30 showing. I got like the last ticket in this particular theater, and I was in the front row, which was like, I haven't been in the front row since I was like 8 years old. So that part of it was kind of painful. But there was some younger kids, 2-3 rows behind me, and they behaved themselves mostly for the most part of the movie. And then it got towards the end, and they started sniggering. And then at the end, the girl, when it was over, the girl pipes up, and she was like, that's it, I want my money back. And you know what? It's one of those, learn the fucking movie, learn a little bit about the fucking movie that you're going to see, so you know what type of movie you're going to see. Not the plot points necessarily, but you know what? It's this young generation, that's where a lot of the hate for The Witch came from. Probably same with The Babadook, probably same with It Follows. It's not the type of horror movie that they want. They want the cat thrown at you every 6 seconds. You know, the hand on the shoulder jump scare, the door opening and someone is right there. That's what they're looking for, and The Witch is not that kind of movie at all. And again, it's the internet, that overload of information. It's gone to the point where, for instance, okay, so the Batman, the Superman movie, I'm almost at the point, because I've been inundated with so much information about it, that
but you know what? Unfortunately, that was then, and this is now. The internet culture is here to stay, and I don't think we're ever going to go back to that. But
no, it's not. And I mean, we're a part of it. We're in the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, all we can do as our part is to, we kind of delve in the, we're kind of the old school guard, as it were, for the kind of movies that that we love, good and bad. And for instance, like, you know, with my dust-offs, I try to provide, it's funny, but I try to keep them spoiler-free. Even if a movie is, like, you know, 40 years old, I try to keep it spoiler-free for that kid who's maybe just coming up and who has a love of old movies, and he's interested in seeing this movie, you know, and I'm thinking, I don't want to spoil it for this kid who hasn't seen this before.
Oh, exactly. And as a corollary to that, we state our biases up front. I thought It Follows was terrific, but I'm not a fan of that genre. So I'll say right up front, I thought it was really well made, but it's not the type of thing I would seek out. But I'm open-minded enough to say, hey, this may be not for me, but it is what it is. And everyone should go into it with an open mind.
Well, absolutely. I mean, again, it's the internet is completely, for the most part, I mean, there are tons of great writers out there who truly have a love of the genres that we do, and go in with that same kind of attitude, which is fantastic. And then there are others who you can just tell by reading an article of theirs that you know what, they didn't like it. I didn't even want to review it, and I hate this kind of movie, and I think it sucks, and I think it's that kind of thing is spilled over from the fandom that we were talking about. Is people not taking that unbiased opinion when they're presenting a review, when they're doing a review. I'm not interested, tell me what the movie is about, A, and tell me what you thought about it, and say, is it good of its kind? Whether you're, like you said, whether you're a fan of that type of movie or not, tell me, is it a good film of its kind? That's why I always loved and still read, you know, like I love reading old Roger Ebert reviews, who wasn't always the biggest fan of the horror genre, but he would champion a movie, say, like the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, or he would champion a movie like the original Dawn of the Dead and the remake. And he would say, you know what, maybe this movie isn't for you, but that doesn't discount what this movie is presenting. Same with The Devil's Rejects. He was one of the few mainstream critics who stood up for The Devil's Rejects and said, hey, whether this is your kind of movie or not, for the kind of movie it is, it's really well made. And so you present the facts. And you say, I think it was really well made. That doesn't mean you're going to like it. But you can't deny a fact is a fact. If something is well made, it's well made. And that's, you know, period, end of sentence. And then you decide whether you're going to go see that based on, you know, whether it's well made and well presented or not.
So, I mean, this is a discussion we can talk about for hours. But, to draw to a close in a sense. So, yeah, going back to the new Hellraiser and all that. I think all of us horror pundits, armchair critics, whatever, we have our knives already drawn, but perhaps the lesson is we should just wait and see. You know what? I mean, looking at the pedigree of this film, most likely it is a cash grab. Most likely it is going to be a steaming turd, but you know what? We may very well be surprised. So I think we need to, as fans, as moviegoers, and in general, we just need to sort of just chill a bit, you know?
Yeah, chill, sit back, let's wait till it comes out. You know, it's always interesting. You know, you do get a good point usually from finding out. Some facts are good to know. Okay, who's making it? Who's writing it? Who's directing it? Who's acting it? You know, those are good starts to find out possibly what kind of movie you're going to get. It doesn't necessarily mean the ingredients. If they're good ingredients, it doesn't mean that souffle could all list 100 examples of you read about the talent involved, and then the thing comes out a hot mess. Making a movie, I'm assuming, is tough business. And even when you think everything's lined up, Monkey Shines, it doesn't always turn out that way. So yeah, Hellraiser, let's wait and see. The new Friday the 13th has gone through so many, you know, different iterations in the past year and a half, you know, being bounced back like a hot potato. A lot of interesting people have been involved. You know, I think they're trying to make a really good Friday the 13th movie. Phantasm Ravager. Look how long that's taken from gestation to making it to the screen. Mm-hmm. You know, Michael Baldwin, on Facebook, he told me, you know, it's, you know, people just need to be patient and they need to realize that, you know, everything has to be lined up perfectly, that we want this movie to come out, but people just need to be patient and it's going to come out and, you know, and you hopefully you won't be disappointed when it does. But, you know, that message is coming from him is, you know, be patient. Just wait. It's coming. You know, when I met Coscarelli almost 2 summers ago now, it was supposed to be coming out in the first quarter of 2015. You know, it's been in the can for a while, but shit happens, and life happens, and business, they're, you know, waiting for the right deal to come along to give the best experience for everyone involved, not only, you know, hopefully for the makers, but most importantly for the fans of a movie. You know, there's a lot of Phantasm lovers out there who are, you know, salivating at this final kick at the can because now that, you know, Angus is no longer with us, mm-hmm. you know, that's it. It's not like we're going to get, you know, God only knows, where are they going to get someone else to play the tall man? No, we're done. Mm-hmm. This is it. So we're all eagerly awaiting this. And, you know, the message, and again, this is coming, you know, right from, you know, a private conversation that I had with him is, you know, be patient. It's coming. And just, you know, people just, like we said, people just need to chill out. It's coming. Mm-hmm. You're going to love it. But it's coming.
And in the meantime, we're still waiting for Bubba Nosferatu, if that ever comes out.
You know, who knows if that's, going to come up.
Exactly.
From all, you know, so we have these beloved franchises, and, you know, in my heart of hearts, I have to believe that the people behind them want to give us something good. Maybe not the studio themselves, the studio, you know, maybe their bottom line is, I want to turn a profit, but you know, as horror lovers, as veteran horror lovers, we want to believe, the optimist in us wants to believe, that the people, the creative team behind it, want to do their best, and they want to give us a good movie. So I always try to come at it from that angle and think, you know what, I don't think that the creative team behind it, I don't think a guy sits down at a laptop to write a draft of a Friday the 13th movie, hoping to make, you know, Friday the 13th Part 5. You know, I'm thinking he's wanting to make Friday the 13th Part 4, or the original. He's shooting for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're hoping it's the fans of this original series that are bringing the fuel to the new stuff. That's the angle that I'm trying to come at, that I'm hoping, you know, that they're coming at it from a place of love.
Well, Scott, I gotta say, as always, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. And if you really are, you know, if you're really ready for you know, to go another round with us, we're eagerly awaiting round 4.
You know what? Round 4 is fine, but please don't make me watch Monkey Shines again, George. I love you.
No. This time, Scott, we're gonna actually be looking at the books. We're gonna make you read the book. How's that?
That's fine. Just don't make me watch Monkey Shines again, George. I love you, George.
We love you too, George.
And speaking of fandom, you know, this is a mutual admiration society, but we're fans of your columns on Daily Dead. They're terrific. We try to get to them as often as we can.
Well, I, th- very much. And you know, let me go all, you know, Sammy Maudlin here and say, you guys are fantastic. For folks, Real Awful Movies is a fantastic website, and you guys' podcasts are always great, and you guys always have great, fun insights on horror movies. And when are you guys dropping that book? And give me the title of the book again, and when is that dropping?
Ah, well, Chris, you want to take this one?
It's called Death by Umbrella, The 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons. And it is coming. It is coming in summer 2016.
It's imminent. It's imminent. We're in the final stages now with the publisher, just getting, you know, dotting the I's, crossing the T's. And it's going to be coming out, I would say, we're hoping within the next couple of months.
Yeah, J.K. Rowling, eat your heart out. We're coming for you.
Wicked. Now, okay, so give me one little taste. Give me one unusual implement, one little tool from Death by Umbrella.
Oh, the dead and buried syringe to the eye, one of my all-time favorites.
Nice.
Although that, but we have weirder ones than that. That's mm-hmm. the thing. I mean, you know, we got things that you wouldn't. Well, I mean, you know, you may have seen, but man, are these horror filmmakers creative in terms of the weaponry they use to? I'll give you one. How about the shish kebab and Happy Birthday to Me?
Oh, I love you guys. I would, if I had a uterus, I would have like brood babies. They'd be ugly.
Anyways, once again, Scott, it's been a pleasure. And, you know, keep on doing what you're doing, and we'll keep on doing what we're doing. And this mutual admiration society will continue.
Meeting adjourned.
Meeting adjourned. Pleasure. Everyone, watch Monkey Shines once. Watch Shockma twice. Take two Advil. And call us in the morning.
Excellent.
Take care.
Take care, Scott.
All right, take care, guys. Thank you.